A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I'll admit, I opened it thinking I knew roughly where this goes. Post-war Europe, television taking off, some bureaucrats in Geneva. But the actual question he's asking is sharper. How did a continent that had just spent 6 years tearing itself apart create a live pan, European Song Contest, broadcast across borders in real time, and somehow make it stick for 7 decades? What was the mechanism, and what were they actually trying to solve?
The mechanism is the part most people skip. Everyone knows the kitsch and the voting blocks and the wind machines. But the founding architecture is genuinely brilliant. You have to understand, in 1955, the idea of a live simultaneous broadcast across multiple countries was technically audacious. This wasn't radio. This was television, which at the time was still a national affair with incompatible standards and no infrastructure for cross-border relay.
So before we even get to the songs, the thing to notice is that Eurovision was a television network before it was a contest. The name itself, Eurovision, predates the song competition by several years. It was an EBU project to create a shared transmission backbone.
The European Broadcasting Union, founded in 1950, was wrestling with a concrete technical problem. Television signals didn't cross borders easily. Every country was building out its own national network, and the idea of linking them was both expensive and politically complicated, but there was enormous appetite for it. The coronation of Queen Elizabeth in 1953 was a watershed. The EBU organized a shared live feed across 5 countries, and it was watched by something like 20 million people in France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, and Britain. That single event proved the model. It showed that a simultaneous transnational television broadcast was not just possible, but massively popular.
Eurovision, the network gets built to do things like coronations and sporting events. And then somebody says, all right, we've got this pipe connecting the continent. What else can we shove through it? And the answer turns out to be a song contest, loosely inspired by an Italian festival.
The Sanremo Music Festival. And this is where the lineage gets direct. Sanremo started in 1951, and it was already a national obsession in Italy. Marcel Bezenton, who was the director general of the EBU at the time, looked at Sanremo and saw a format that could translate beautifully to television. Live performances, a competition structure, built-in national stakes, and crucially, it didn't require simultaneous translation. Music crosses language barriers in a way that drama or news programming couldn't.
Bezenken is a name worth sitting on for a second. Swiss, former journalist, ran the EBU from its founding. And, by all accounts, he was the kind of bureaucrat who thought in infrastructure rather than programming. He wasn't asking, what show should we make? He was asking, what format exploits the network we just built?
And that framing explains why Eurovision succeeded where other international cultural projects failed. It was reverse-engineered from the pipe. The first contest, in Lugano in 1956, was technically a trial run for the network as much as a cultural event. 7 countries participated, each submitting 2 songs. Switzerland won, which is almost too tidy. And the whole thing was broadcast on radio as well, because television penetration was still quite patchy, but the architecture was in place.
Let me poke at the political layer, because I think Daniel's question is implicitly about that too. You've got 1956. The war ended barely a decade earlier. The European coal and steel community is just getting off the ground. The Treaty of Rome is still a year away, and here are 7 countries, including West Germany and Italy, sitting together in Switzerland, singing at each other on live television. That's not nothing.
It's not nothing, and it wasn't accidental. The EBU was founded explicitly as a non-political organization, and its membership rules were drawn up to keep the Cold War from splitting European broadcasting. The Soviet bloc had its own parallel organization, the International Radio and Television Organization, or OIRT. The EBU drew a line down the continent, and Eurovision sat firmly on the western side. But within that western bloc, the contest functioned as a kind of soft diplomacy. You couldn't explicitly celebrate post-war reconciliation on a variety show without it feeling heavy-handed, but you could have Germany perform a Schlager number right after France and let the audience draw its own conclusions.
The voting mechanism. This is the part that always struck me as the most quietly ingenious element. National juries, points awarded live, each country's results transmitted back over the same network. It created a feedback loop that made the audience feel like participants in a shared continental event, rather than passive viewers of a foreign broadcast.
The original voting system was actually quite different from what people picture today. In the early years, it was just juries in each country, and the results were often communicated by telephone. There was no live satellite link showing the jury spokespeople. That came much later. And the scoring was frequently controversial in exactly the way that makes for compulsive viewing. In 1969, four countries tied for first place, and there was no tiebreak rule, so they all won. France, Spain, the UK, and the Netherlands. The following year, they introduced a tiebreak rule, and several countries briefly withdrew in protest over the whole fiasco.
That is such a beautifully European solution to a problem. Nobody wins. Everybody wins. We'll fix the rules next year.
That's the thing. The contest has always been a pressure valve for exactly the kind of grievances that, in other contexts, would play out through much more serious channels. The persistent complaints about block voting, the accusations of political bias, the tactical point exchanges between neighboring countries. It's a low-stakes simulation of European political dynamics, and I think that's part of why it endures. You get all the drama of international rivalry with none of the consequences.
There's also a technical arms race angle here that I think gets undercovered. The contest became a showcase for broadcast engineering. Every host country wanted to demonstrate that its national broadcaster was at the cutting edge. Color television, stereo sound, satellite uplinks, eventually high definition, and augmented reality stage design. Eurovision was the place where European public broadcasters showed off to each other and to their domestic audiences.
The BBC in particular treated it as a production proving ground. When the UK hosted, they threw enormous resources at it, and this created a feedback loop with the technology vendors. If you could make your equipment work reliably for a live Eurovision final with 300 million people watching, you could sell it anywhere. The contest drove standardization in ways that formal committees sometimes couldn't.
I want to circle back to the San Remo connection, because there's a cultural lineage here that explains a lot about what the contest became. San Remo was, and is, a very Italian thing. Melodramatic ballads, orchestral arrangements, a certain theatricality that reads as earnest rather than ironic. Eurovision inherited that DNA, and for decades it was defined by it. The pivot toward camp and self-aware spectacle came much later, really in the 90s and 2000s.
That pivot is fascinating because it wasn't planned. It emerged from the tension between countries that still took the contest seriously as a songwriting competition and countries, Ireland in the 90s being the prime example, that figured out how to game the format. Ireland won 4 times in 5 years in the 1990s by sending carefully crafted, broadly appealing pop songs with strong staging. That period changed the strategic calculus for everyone. Suddenly, you had to think about camera angles and lighting cues and the 3-minute dramatic arc in a way that earlier participants hadn't.
There's also the language rule, which went through several iterations and tells you a lot about the cultural politics. Originally, each country sang in its own language. Then in the 70s, they liberalized it and you got a wave of English language entries. Then they brought the language rule back. Then they dropped it again in 1999. Each flip was a proxy fight about cultural sovereignty versus commercial reach.
The commercial reach question is real. Once the contest expanded beyond the core Western European countries, particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union, the audience grew massively. The 1990s and 2000s saw a wave of new entrants from Central and Eastern Europe. The EBU had to expand the format, introduce semifinals, rethink the voting. The contest in 2004 in Istanbul was the first to have a semifinal, and it was a direct response to the fact that there were suddenly 30-plus countries wanting to participate.
The semifinal innovation is a good example of the EBU doing what it's always done well, which is solving a logistical problem with a format change that ends up making the product better. The semifinals are now major television events in their own right, and they give smaller countries a moment in the spotlight even if they don't make the final.
The voting reform in 2016, where they split the jury and public vote, was another one of those structural pivots. It was introduced after years of complaints that block voting was making the results predictable and unfair. The split revealed something interesting. The juries and the public often have completely different preferences. The jury tends to reward vocal technique and composition. The public rewards memorability and spectacle. Seeing those two sets of points diverge in real time is dramatic television.
Let me pull the thread Daniel is actually tugging at. The question is how it became a thing, and I think the answer has three layers. Layer one is the technical infrastructure. Without the EBU's network and the drive to justify its existence, there's no format. Layer two is the political moment. Post-war Europe needed symbols of cooperation that didn't require treaty negotiations. A song contest is perfect for that. Layer three is the format's adaptability. Every time the contest has faced an existential challenge, whether it's too many countries or changing musical tastes or accusations of corruption, the EBU has tweaked the rules rather than abandoning the project.
I'd add a fourth layer, which is that public service broadcasters needed Eurovision as much as Eurovision needed them. In an era when state broadcasters were losing audience share to commercial competitors, Eurovision was one of the few properties that reliably delivered enormous ratings and couldn't be replicated by a private network. It's a public service monopoly on a pan-European scale. That institutional protection gave it the space to survive some truly terrible years in the 2000s when the music was widely mocked and the reputation was at a low point.
The survival through those low points is actually the strongest evidence for the institutional argument. If Eurovision were purely a commercial product, it would have been canceled a dozen times over. But because it's owned by a consortium of public broadcasters who don't answer primarily to shareholders, it can absorb a bad decade and come back stronger.
It did come back. The last 10 or 15 years have seen a remarkable rehabilitation of the contest's cultural status. A lot of that is down to the production values. The stage design has become world class, the lighting rigs, the LED screens, the kinetic scenery. It's a long way from Lugano in 1956, where the stage was basically a curtain and some potted plants.
I want to mention Australia because it's the exception that proves the rule about Eurovision being a European thing. Australia was invited as a one-off guest in 2015 for the 60th anniversary, and then they just kept getting invited back. They're now effectively a permanent participant. And the reason they got the invitation in the first place is that Eurovision has been broadcast in Australia for decades and has a surprisingly devoted following. The EBU bent its own geographic rules because the audience demand was there.
Australia's participation also highlights something about the time zone absurdity of the whole enterprise. The contest airs at 5 in the morning Australian Eastern Time, and people still watch it live. That's the kind of irrational commitment that only a truly cultural institution can command.
There's a broader media history point here, too. Eurovision is one of the last remaining examples of appointment television. In an era of on-demand streaming and fragmented audiences, the Eurovision final is a live, simultaneous, continent-wide event that demands to be watched in real time. You can't binge it. You can't skip to the end. The voting window closes, and if you weren't watching, you missed it. That scarcity is incredibly valuable now in a way that it wasn't 20 years ago, when live television was just how television worked.
The social media layer has amplified that rather than cannibalizing it. Twitter during Eurovision is a parallel event. The memes, the commentary, the collective mockery, and occasional genuine admiration. It's a second screen experience that feeds back into the live broadcast cultural weight. The EBU was quite smart about embracing that rather than fighting it.
All right, let me test a counter-narrative. There's a reading of Eurovision that says it was never really about music. It was always a vehicle for national broadcasters to justify their technical budgets and for governments to wave flags in a low-cost, low-risk way. The songs were incidental. Is that too cynical?
It's not entirely wrong, but it's incomplete. The technical justification piece is real, especially in the early decades. But the songs mattered to audiences from day one. The first winner, Lice Asha's Refrain, was a genuine hit in several countries, and the contest has launched actual careers. ABBA in 1974 is the canonical example, but Celine Dion won for Switzerland in 1988, and she did all right. The music industry has always had an ambivalent relationship with Eurovision, but the audience connection is undeniable.
ABBA is the example, but it's also the exception that proves how rare genuine global breakout is. Most Eurovision winners have a moment and then fade outside their home market. The contest relationship with the commercial music industry has always been awkward. It's too pop for the art music crowd and too kitsch for the serious pop market.
Which is exactly why the audience took ownership of it in a way that bypassed the gatekeepers. The camp appreciation, the drinking games, the viewing parties, Eurovision became a folk event that happened to be televised. And once that cultural layer solidified, the music industry's opinion stopped mattering. The contest didn't need radio play or chart success to be relevant. It had its own ecosystem.
Let's talk about the cost, because this is a recurring tension that Daniel's probably aware of. Hosting Eurovision is ruinously expensive. Countries have literally gone broke doing it. The host broadcaster shoulders the bulk of the production cost, and the figure can run into the tens of millions of euros. For smaller countries, winning is a mixed blessing.
There have been several cases where the winning country openly worried about its ability to host the following year. Ukraine has had to navigate that multiple times, for obvious reasons. The EBU has occasionally stepped in with financial guarantees or co-hosting arrangements. Australia offered to co-host if Ukraine couldn't manage it, which was a nice gesture, but also a reminder that the contest's economics are fundamentally precarious. It works because everyone agrees it should work, not because the business model is ironclad.
The precariousness is part of the charm, honestly. If Eurovision were a slick, perfectly optimized corporate product, it wouldn't have the same hold on people. The rough edges, the occasional technical disaster, the visibly nervous hosts reading cue cards in heavily accented English. It feels human in a way that most global television doesn't.
The multilingual hosting is a specific choice that reinforces that. The presenters typically switch between English, French, and sometimes the host country's language. French is there because it's the EBU's other official language, and also because France would probably secede from the contest if it weren't. But the effect is that the broadcast feels European rather than just English language international. You're reminded every few minutes that you're watching something from a specific place with its own linguistic reality.
The French point is not even a joke. The language parity between English and French is written into the EBU's charter. The points are always announced in both languages. Dow's points, 12 points. It's a small thing, but it's a structural commitment to the idea that this is a bilingual institution.
It connects back to Besançon and the founding vision. The EBU was created to be a multilateral organization at a time when most international bodies were dominated by one or two powers. The dual language requirement, the rotating hosting duties, the one country, one vote jury system. All of it was designed to prevent any single country from capturing the institution.
Which brings us to the block voting thing, because that's the persistent critique that won't die. Greece and Cyprus exchange 12 points every year. The Nordic countries cluster. The former Soviet republics have patterns. People get very exercised about this, and I think they're missing the point.
The block voting is real, but it's also completely explicable. Neighboring countries share musical tastes, cultural references, diaspora populations, and in many cases, language. A Romanian ballot is going to land differently in Moldova than in Portugal. That's not corruption. That's cultural proximity. And the evidence shows that when you control for those factors, the block effects shrink considerably. There was a paper a few years back that analyzed decades of voting data and found that musical quality proxies, things like song tempo and key and genre, explain more of the variance than geographic proximity did.
I love that someone did a regression analysis on Eurovision voting patterns. That is peak academic energy applied to the most delightful possible subject.
There are multiple papers. It's a whole subfield.
Of course there are. All right. Let's step back to the founding moment one more time, because I think there's a detail that deserves more attention. The first contest in 1956 was not called the Eurovision Song Contest. At least not consistently. It was the Eurovision Grand Prix, or sometimes just the Grand Prix de la Chanson Européenne. The branding wasn't settled yet, and it was a very small affair by modern standards. The venue in Lugano was a theater that seated about 600 people.
The orchestra was a local ensemble. There were no pyrotechnics, no LED walls, no wind machines, just 7 countries, 14 songs, and a live radio and television relay that was, by the standards of the time, a minor miracle. The fact that it worked at all was the story. The fact that it produced a format durable enough to still be running 70 years later is astonishing.
The orchestra point is worth dwelling on, because the live orchestra requirement was a defining feature of the contest for its first 4 decades. Every entry had to be performed with the host broadcaster's orchestra, which meant that arrangements had to be scored and delivered in advance, and the rehearsals were a massive logistical undertaking. The orchestra was dropped in 1999, partly for cost reasons and partly because contemporary pop production didn't translate well to a 60-piece ensemble.
That change in 99 was controversial at the time, and it marked a real shift. It opened the door to the kind of pre-recorded backing tracks and electronic production that dominate the contest now. Some people argue it made the contest more musically current. Others say it lost something essential. I think both things are true. The live orchestra forced a certain kind of musical craftsmanship that's no longer required, but it also limited the range of genres that could compete effectively.
The 99 contest is also notable because it was the year the language rule was permanently liberalized, and you saw an immediate effect. Countries that had previously been constrained by their domestic language started submitting songs in English with an eye toward broader appeal. The strategic calculus shifted overnight.
That brings us to the current era, where the contest is global in its reach, with viewing figures in the hundreds of millions, a massive online presence, and a cultural footprint that extends far beyond Europe. The EBU has managed something that almost no other post-war institution has achieved. It created a cultural tradition from scratch, built on top of a technical network, and sustained it across generational turnover, technological disruption, and massive geopolitical change.
The more I think about it, the more I think the secret is that Eurovision was never really about the songs. The songs are the excuse. The thing itself is a ritual of European self-definition that updates itself annually. Every year, the contest asks and answers the same question. What does Europe sound like right now? And the answer changes. Sometimes it's a Norwegian fiddle duo. Sometimes it's an Italian rock band. Sometimes it's a Ukrainian rat folk hybrid. Sometimes it's a Finnish monster metal act in full prosthetics. The diversity is the point.
The diversity extends to the winners. Look at the past decade. You've had winners from Austria, Ukraine, Portugal, Israel, the Netherlands, Italy, Sweden, Switzerland. No single country or region dominates. The contest structure rewards a broad range of approaches, and the jury public split voting system makes it very hard to win purely on block support or purely on spectacle. You need both.
Israel's wins are an interesting case study because they highlight the contest's complicated relationship with its own geographic boundaries. Israel has been participating since 1973, and it's won 4 times. The participation is justified through EBU membership rather than geographic Europeanness, same as Australia's current status. And it's occasionally been a flashpoint, but the EBU has consistently held the line that membership is about the broadcasting union, not the continent.
Morocco participated once, in 1980, and Lebanon was supposed to debut in 2005, but withdrew. The Arab world's relationship with the contest has been complicated for obvious political reasons. But Israel's sustained participation and occasional wins are a reminder that the contest's definition of Europe has always been institutional rather than strictly geographic.
All right, I think we've covered the how. Let me try to synthesize the why, because that's the deeper question. Why did this particular format survive when so many other post-war cultural projects faded? I think it's because Eurovision solved a coordination problem that no single country could solve alone. It created a shared cultural calendar event that required cooperation to produce, but rewarded national pride in the outcome. It's a prisoner's dilemma, where the dominant strategy is to participate enthusiastically.
That's a very corn way of putting it, but I think you're right. The game theory of it is actually quite elegant. If you participate, you get a moment of national attention, a chance to showcase your culture and your broadcast capabilities, and a shot at winning and hosting next year. If you don't participate, you're absent from the conversation and your absence is noted. The cost of participation is real, but the cost of non-participation is arguably higher in terms of soft power and cultural visibility.
The cost-benefit calculus shifts depending on your domestic politics. For some countries, Eurovision is a harmless bit of fun that nobody takes too seriously. For others, it's a genuine arena for national assertion. The Baltic countries treated their post-Soviet participation as a statement of European identity. Ukraine's wins have been moments of intense national pride and international solidarity. The stakes are real even when the format is frivolous.
The 2022 contest is the clearest example of this. Ukraine won in a landslide with an enormous public vote that was widely interpreted as a gesture of solidarity. The EBU tried very hard to keep the contest apolitical, but the audience made its own meaning, and that's been true since the beginning. You can't put 30-plus countries in a room, ask them to vote for each other, and pretend geopolitics doesn't exist. The contest channels those energies into a manageable form.
To answer Daniel's question directly, how did Eurovision become a thing? Step 1. The EBU builds a cross-border television network to share big events like coronations and sports. Step 2. A Swiss bureaucrat named Marcel Bezanson looks at Italy's Sanremo Festival and realizes the format is perfect for exploiting that network. Step 3. The first contest in 1956 proves the concept, and the combination of technical achievement, soft diplomacy, and genuine audience appeal creates a self-sustaining institution. Step 4. 70 years of rule tweaks, format innovations, and cultural evolution turn it into the strange and wonderful thing it is today.
Step 5. The internet era transforms it from a European television event into a global cultural phenomenon without breaking the core format. That's the part that really impresses me. Most 20th century broadcast institutions have been hollowed out by streaming and social media. Eurovision has been strengthened by them.
The final thought I'll offer is that Eurovision is a reminder that institutions matter. The EBU is not glamorous. It's a technical standards body and a trade association for public broadcasters. But it created and sustained something that no commercial entity could have built. The contest exists because a bunch of engineers and bureaucrats in the 1950s decided that connecting European television networks was worth doing, and then someone had the imagination to put a song contest on the resulting infrastructure. The rest is history, but it's history with a very specific institutional backbone.
The backbone is still there. The EBU still runs the contest, still arbitrates the rules, still manages the technical standards. It's a continuity that spans from the age of vacuum tubes to the age of fiber optics and streaming. That's remarkable.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, Portuguese sailors in the Azores observed that certain lichens growing on the volcanic rocks produced a deep purple dye when treated with aged urine and quicklime. The pigment, later called azores, purple, or archil, was derived from orchil lichens and contained the compound orchin. Its color chemistry depends on a reversible acid-base reaction that shifts from red in acidic conditions to blue-purple in alkaline environments. The pigment was eventually superseded by synthetic aniline dyes in the 19th century, but for a brief window, the Azores were the unlikely center of a niche colorant trade supplying Flemish and Italian textile dyers.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.